to be true. Maybe you do believe that it's true, but you're struggling with doubt. Maybe that's doubt that's always been there. Maybe it's doubt that's come on more recently, either because of something that someone else has said, or because of something you've read, or because of a life situation that's come your way. You sing along, but your heart's not really in the words like it used to be. And you aren't really confident to stake very much on the fact that this is true. You keep coming back. But if you're honest, you're holding back. And therefore, your life looks pretty similar to your neighbors, your colleagues, because you're not really sure it's worth changing. If you're in either of those categories this morning, what you need are reasons to believe that this is true. Reasons to know that this is true. Reasons to shape your life around it so that you know that it's not a risk, but a sure bet. Many of us this morning will be pretty confident in what we think and believe. My hope this morning is that these words will reassure us, as well as challenging us to live rightly in response to what we hear. This morning, Jesus, through this passage, is going to give us two big reasons to believe. The first of those we'll see with him as we look back to that night before he was crucified. The second we're to see by looking around us. So first, together, we'll look back. The night before Jesus' death, and we hear Jesus say to us, "Despite my betrayal, believe that I am. Despite my betrayal, believe that I am." Many of us would have been here last week. If you were, trace your mind back to where we were. If you weren't, let me catch you up. It's the night before Jesus dies. He's in a room with his disciples. They're having a meal together, a Passover meal, a special meal. And Jesus has just done the most incredible, shocking thing. He got down on his hands and knees and washed his disciples' filthy, smelly feet. The God of the universe, the one who occupies the highest place, occupied the lowest place. That happened, and then the meal went on. And Jesus shifts the conversation. And he does it in a way that none of those disciples that night were expecting. Verse 18, he starts to speak of how what's about to happen is going to fulfill a passage of scripture. "He who shared my bread has turned against me." It's a quote from a psalm, Psalm 41. A psalm of David. David, the former king of Israel, who was betrayed. He's speaking of that time when he was betrayed. Betrayed by someone close to him. And Jesus is saying, what happened to him is happening to me. Hard to imagine just how shocked the room would have felt at that moment. If you'd have been there, you'd have felt all the energy in the room just drop out in a split second. The disciples, their emotions would have been in turmoil. But the focus actually isn't so much on their emotions. It's on Jesus's. Verse 21. After he'd said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit. That word troubled, it's come up a few times before in John's Gospel. Perhaps most evocatively back in chapter 5. Chapter 5, do you remember the story? There's the paralyzed man by the edge of the pool, desperate to be healed. And the waters kind of bubble up. They get stirred up. And that word stirred, that's the word here for troubled. It's as if they're saying, John's saying, Jesus' emotions are churning up inside him like water churning around. Jesus churned up inside because he knows what's coming. Striking that that word is also used in the first verse after our passage when Jesus says to his disciples, "Do not let your heart be troubled." As if John is telling us Jesus' spirit was troubled, so our hearts need not be. He stands in our place. He takes that on himself. He is the one whose heart is troubled for our sakes. It's troubled because, as he goes on, verse 21, "Very truly I tell you, one of you is going to betray me." up to that point, maybe the disciples were thinking, well, Jesus has shared bread with a lot of people in the last 3 years. Maybe it's one of them that's going to betray him. It could be anyone. But no, Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. Imagine the looks around the room, the awkward looks, trying to catch everyone's eye but not let them catch your eye. The stress, the tension in that moment. One of the most successful things on television at the moment, you may be a massive fan, you may not be, is The Traitors. Why is it so successful? Lots of reasons, but one of them is because this kind of moment is full of tension and drama, isn't it? The thought that you're sitting around with a group of people, but one of them isn't who they say they are. It is that dynamic that has caught the attention of millions of people here around a table. One of them is a traitor. But it's so much more significant than a game show. There, they've only known each other for a couple of weeks. These 12 friends have spent 3 years together. There, it's just a game. Yes, there's some money on the line, but it's just a game. Here, life is on the line. In fact, eternal realities are on the line because of who Jesus says he is. Unsurprisingly, in that moment, the disciples, they want to know which of them it is. So Peter motions to another disciple, the one described as the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's John, the writer's way of describing himself. It's the first time that's come up in John's gospel. That's not his way of saying he loves me more than all the others. It's his way of saying, I know I'm only a disciple because Jesus set his love on me. I've done nothing to deserve this. Anyway, Peter says to John, ask him, you're sitting next to him, you ask him which one it is. And John kind of leans in and asks Jesus, who is it? And in a moment of high drama, verse 26, Jesus says, it is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I've dipped it in the dish. Imagine all the disciples being strapped to heart rate monitors in that moment. What would the readings be like? The other disciples were all probably sitting there thinking, does he know something about me that I don't know? Am I the one? If not, is it someone I trusted most? Who is it? Judas, heart pounding. Is he on to me? Has he worked it out? Jesus dips the bread and he lifts it and he starts to move it. And you imagine that moment, about half the room breathe a sigh of relief as they realize it's going away from them and not towards them. And more people breathing that sigh of relief as it's not coming to them until eventually it reaches Judas. Judas, son of Simon Iscariot. The relief turns to shock. Judas? Really? We obviously know him as Judas. The word Judas for us means kind of one who betrays people, and so we're not surprised, but they would have been. He was the one who was trusted with the money bag. And he turns out to be the traitor, tempted by Satan, giving in to his desires. It's Judas, the traitor. Jesus not only confirms that Judas is the one who will betray him, he then speaks to Judas and he says, what you're about to do, go and do it quickly. Jesus sits in control, even of his betrayer. Disciples don't understand. What's Jesus sending Judas to do? Surely no one would ever command someone to betray them. So they just assume maybe this betrayal is going to come down the line sometime. And for now, Jesus is just treating Judas normally and sending him out to do the kind of jobs he'd normally be doing. But as it is, after Judas had taken the bread, he went out. And the section ends with four chilling words. And it was night. Those words are chilling for Jesus, because that is the sun going down on Jesus' freedom. That's it for him. Next time it's night, Jesus isn't in a room. He's in a tomb. It's chilling for Jesus. It's chilling for Judas because Judas leaves the light of the world. He goes out into the night. Why? Because he is of the night. In John's gospel, light and darkness is a huge theme. We've seen that as we've traveled through. Words are going to come up on the screen from John chapter 3. We were told light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come to the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. Here is Judas, whose deeds were evil, scuttling off into the night, going away from the light of the world, never to return to him. I don't think those words, it was night, chilling for us all. It's a description of our world in many ways, isn't it? A world where, yes, the light shines in the darkness, but our world is a world of darkness because we have cast out the light. And so, for us too, in a sense, we live in a world of night, waiting for light to break back in. Jesus betrayed. Betrayed by someone close to him. And before we go any further, we need to just stop on that for a moment. Because for some of us this morning, that is a hugely significant thought. Because you know what it is to be betrayed by someone close to you. That secret sin that you shared in confidence and now everyone seems to know. That struggle that you were honest about with one person hoping to seek help from them and now other people seem to be talking about it. The person you trusted who turned their back on you. The promise that you clung to but someone else broke. If that's your experience, Jesus knows what that feels like. He can empathize with that. He has been betrayed. It's a wonderful thought for us, a comfort for us if we know what it is to be betrayed. But I don't think it's the main thing John wants us to take away from this section. In fact, Jesus tells us the main thing he wants us to take away because he tells us why he's telling the disciples about his betrayal. Did you notice it? Verse 19, we skipped over it. Let's come back to it. Jesus says, I'm telling you now before it happens so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am who I am. Or literally, that you will believe that I am. You will believe that God has turned up in human flesh and it's me. Because if he doesn't warn them beforehand, you can imagine the logic, can't you? The disciples think, well, God knows everything. And so if Jesus is betrayed, he clearly didn't know who Judas really was, and therefore he can't really be God. It's a relatively logical set of steps to take. And so Jesus tells them beforehand, so that they know he is who he says he is. He has not been blindsided. He didn't have the wool pulled over his eyes by Judas. No, he knew beforehand. He let it happen. He commanded it to happen. Our first key reason to believe this morning. Jesus isn't an innocent bystander. Jesus isn't just someone who's really good at judging the room and just got a sense that Judas was a bit off with him. No, he knows because he's God. He alone sees people's hearts. He alone knows their future actions. He alone knows what Judas is about to do. And even in this most vulnerable moment, even in this moment where Jesus is about to be betrayed, he's still in control. He knows what's going to happen and even commands his betrayer to get on and do it. You're unconvinced by Jesus. If you doubt he is who he says he is, here's a question for you to ponder. Who else would act like this in the moment they're about to be betrayed? Who else in the face of betrayal would have the confidence to call it out to know it's coming, and to tell that person to get on and do it. Other than the one who knows what is coming and knows he's going to come out the other side. It's our first big reason to believe. Despite my betrayal, Jesus says, believe that I am. It comes as we look back to that night. Our second comes as we look round. Our second reason this morning. After my departure, love one another. It's going to help us to see how that reason works out. See, with Judas gone, the countdown clock is ticking. The countdown clock is ticking for Jesus' departure. Everything's in place. It's all ready to happen. This is Jesus' last chance to speak to the remaining 11 disciples. Tells them what's about to happen. And he describes it in terms of him being about to be glorified. God is going to glorify the Son at once. Jesus is talking about going to the cross. Jesus is talking about hanging on an instrument of torture, and he describes that as being glorified. It's a strange thought. If we've not heard it before, it should surprise us, I think. If we have heard it before, we need to recapture that surprise. How is someone hanging on an instrument of torture glorious? In fact, God would say there is nothing more glorious that has ever happened on the face of this earth than someone hanging on a cross. And not just anyone hanging, but God's beloved Son who took on flesh. How is that glorious? Because in that moment, God shows us everything about himself. He shows us what he is truly like. He shows us that he is the kind of God who doesn't use power for his own advantage, but makes himself nothing, taking on the form of a servant to save those who need saving. He is a God who is willing to come from the highest place to the utter lowest place. And he's willing to do it to stand in our place. Because what does Jesus do on that cross? He pays the penalty that we need. He bears the cost so that we don't have to. He stands in our place. It upends every human instinct for how we think glory works. We think glory relates to someone's skills or achievements, what they can boast about on their CV or whatever it is. But no, glory comes in service. Glory comes in sacrifice. That is where love is truly seen. Jesus is heading off to that place of glory. He's heading to the place of execution. Then he'll head out through the grave, out the other side, and up to be with his Father. And Jesus says to his disciples, for now they can't follow him. Verse 33, where I am going, you cannot come. But as they wait, they're not just meant to sit and twiddle their thumbs. No, he gives them a new command, verse 34. A new command I give you, love one another. And our first question needs to be, in what sense is this command new? I think it's new in at least two ways. It's marking out a new community. He's waited till the traitor is gone and the 11 remain. Those who believe in Jesus, those who are shaped by listening to him. And to that community, he says, love one another. A new community given a new model. Love one another as I have loved you. The way God's people are to love one another is shaped on the way Jesus loved us, putting ourselves and our advantage to one side, and instead thinking about the good of the other, whatever it costs. That's the call. It's a hard call, but that's the call. This week, I found out why Maundy Thursday is called Maundy Thursday. Maybe I'm like the last person to know this. Maybe you all know and I'm just late. Maundy Thursday is called Maundy Thursday because Maundy comes from the word for commandment from Latin. Because of this moment, a new commandment I give to you. Why do I tell you that? Is that pointless trivia? No. Because what I want you to think this morning is today is Maundy Sunday, and tomorrow is Maundy Monday, and the day after that is Maundy Tuesday, and on it goes. Because every day is to be shaped by this command. Every day we are called to love one another. And what's the result of living this out? It will give people a reason to believe. Verse 35. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. If you doubt that Jesus is who he says he is, whether you're kind of, you don't believe in him and you're just looking into things, or whether you do but you're kind of grappling with whether to really wholeheartedly commit to him, Jesus says, look around. Look around at the community of love that I am creating. Look at how my people treat each other. That will show you that I am who I say I am. So the call is to look around, to see, to notice how God's people, the church, treats one another. If you have been part of churches for a while, some of these things we get so used to that we don't realize, I think, how remarkable they are to many of our friends who aren't Christians. If someone in the church family has a baby or has a significant operation or suffers a bereavement and the church family gather around them and cook meals for them, we think that's pretty normal. If you've got friends who've had kids relatively recently, go and ask them what others did for them. They kind of just left us to it. They're staggered at the thought that people would help and step in and do everything they can in those early days. You see it in all kinds of other things. You see it in the busy mum who goes out of her way to care for someone who is elderly. Not seeking praise or recognition, but just knowing that is someone you need to love. You see it in the person who takes someone into their guest room for a little while, even though they hardly know them. You see it in the way that someone receives a Christmas bonus and their immediate thought isn't, great, what can I spend it on, but who needs this more than I do? You see it in the person who offers a friend, I'll ring you. My phone will be there, ready. Ring me whenever you want to. Any time of night or day, I'll be there, ready to answer, because I know you need that right now. Because they value the other person more than they value their sleep. Those are just small things, but they all add up. That is the kind of love that Jesus envisages, and that is the kind of love that will convince people, that will show people that we truly are Jesus' disciples. I was talking to a friend this week who's a pastor about this passage, and here's what he said about this dynamic. It was what brought me back to church, and ultimately to faith at the age of 14. I was blown away by a bunch of teenagers who genuinely cared for each other, didn't gossip, and were consistent in friendship. He saw a bunch of people who lived differently, and it convinced him that it was true. Notice how young that starts. It's not something just for grown-ups. It's something all of God's people are to live out in how they relate to one another. Let's not be unrealistic. We don't do that perfectly, do we? We mess up in all kinds of ways. Some of us will have some pretty painful stories of the way that churches have messed up and not done this right. We all see it in headlines every now and then as the church is exposed. It's why it's such a tragedy when that happens. Because we are called to love one another, and that is meant to display to the world that we are Jesus' disciples. So no wonder when we mess it up that they think we're not. They think he's not real. But equipped by God's Spirit, we are to love one another. As we look to Jesus' example, we see the model of love, and that is what we are to follow. It's what we long to grow in more and more. We can only do it with his help, by the power of his Spirit. And Jesus says that as others see this, as others see the way we live, they will grasp that we're living for something different, that we're living for someone different, that we have a whole new way of living. And that will show them something. So if you're here this morning and you're not convinced by Jesus, look around. We're not perfect. We don't want to brag about ourselves at all, but do you know other communities like this that show that kind of love, that are willing to go to that kind of depth, that are willing to give of themselves in those ways and many other ways that we could list? Because that's supposed to mark us out as different. Can you see that? You noticed it. To those of us who are convinced, who are seeking to love one another, who are part of this community, remember what we have isn't ordinary. So many people in our world are longing for community, and we have it because Jesus makes it and Jesus shapes it. It's one of the reasons we're putting on board games evenings. They're not complicated, they're not impressive, but it's a chance for those who don't know Jesus to see something of how Christians treat one another, to see some of that love in action, to see that maybe this community is one that has got something, that knows something, that is different somehow. Do make the most of next Saturday and then others later in the year. Because we long, don't we, that our friends will know that we are Jesus' disciples, and they'll see that as they see the way we love one another. But before we close, we need to drop back into the passage because one more thing happens. Peter asks a question. He says, "Lord, where are you going?" Seems like he's kind of missed the new command because he's so focused on the thought that Jesus is leaving. And Jesus says, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." He says, "Why can't I follow now? I'll lay down my life for you." And Jesus says, "No, you won't. Instead, you're actually going to deny me, disown me 3 times. Peter needs to slow down. Peter needs to step back. Peter needs to remember who it is that lays down whose life first. That phrase is striking, isn't it? "I will lay down my life for you." What happened in John 10? The good shepherd will lay down his life for the sheep. That's the order. Jesus lays down his life for the sheep. We don't come up with incredible things that we do of acts of sacrifice to show God how wonderful we are. No. The shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. That is why Peter can't follow yet. Because that hasn't happened yet. He must first accept Jesus lays down his life for him. God is a God of grace. God is the one who does it all. And when he does, when Jesus has laid down his life for him, when Jesus has ascended into heaven and sent his Spirit to equip Peter and others to live God's way, then Peter will follow. Then he will lay down his life for Jesus. He will do it in sacrificial love for God's people. And eventually he will do it as he dies as a martyr. Peter will lay down his life, but not yet. Because first he needs Jesus to lay down his life for him. So as we come into land, why believe? Whether you're a skeptic looking in or whether you're longing to follow Jesus but grappling with doubt, why believe? Look back at Jesus himself, the one who is in utter control even in the moment of his own betrayal. Believe that he is the I Am. He is God. And look around. Look around at the love of God's people, a love patterned on Jesus' love for us. Look at the community of love that it creates, a community that proclaims that we are Jesus' disciples. And then if you've come to believe that, live it out. Looking to Jesus, enabled by his Spirit, love one another. Not something we dredge up from within us, but no, we see what he has done for us. We know that he is at work by his Spirit to help us. And so we love one another. And we do that knowing what Jesus says it can achieve, that it will proclaim to the world who we follow, and it will call the world to follow him too. Let me lead us in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for Jesus. The I Am, God come to earth to